On July 30, 2020, Montana No Kid Hungry in HRDC District 9 in Bozeman held a virtual panel discussion titled Poverty and the Pandemic, exploring the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic on our community. Three panelists shared their insights, two of whom are Amplify Montana members, Rima Zabian and Lori Lundgren, have firsthand experience navigating life during the pandemic with limited resources, and Tara Jensen, co-director of the Montana Budget and Policy Center. The discussion was facilitated by Elizabeth Marum of TRIO Student Support Services at Montana State University.
TRIO is a half-century-old program of the Department of Education that supports students of lesser means, those whose parents don't have a college degree, and students with disabilities. And it works from middle school through college. These students are here to achieve the education of their dreams. And they are the people that I admire most. They work hard and they know that education offers them a better trajectory for themselves and their families. They serve as an example and a reminder to me that we can be great. We can achieve. Sometimes we need help. This webinar is co-sponsored through HRDC in Bozeman and Montana No Kids Hungry. These are two organizations have collaborated together on Montana No Kids Hungry Amplify Montana Initiative, which is an effort to build the leadership and advocacy skills of people who have lived experience with poverty. Their goal is to elevate the voices of community members so that they can be catalysts of change around the issues that impact them. We have three panelists here today who are going to discuss the COVID-19 pandemic and how it relates to issues of poverty. Two of our panelists are Amplify Montana members, Rima Zabian and Lori Lindgren. They are joined by Tara Jensen, who is co-director of the Montana Budget and Policy Center. So with that, let's have the panelists introduce themselves. Lori, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your family.
Hi. As Elizabeth mentioned, I am Lori Lindgren. I'm a single mom who's been living in the Gallatin Valley for the past 8 years. Currently, I am a second year master's student at MSU in the community health program. I and three of my children live in family graduate housing at MSU. I work part-time for the Center for American Indian Rural Health Equity at MSU. And as Elizabeth mentioned, I am a member of the Amplify Montana Speakers Bureau in Bozeman. My family and I, as well as so many others, have been negatively impacted by COVID-19, and I'm here today to share some of those experiences with you.
Rima, how about you?
Thank you so much for being here and for you inviting me to share my experience. I have been a resident of Bozeman for about 18 months now. I'm a Canadian citizen. My almost ex-husband is an American citizen, and we moved to Bozeman last year for his work. We lived in New York City for 4 years prior to that. And so I have a two and a half year old now. And I also was a member of the Amplify Montana Speaker Series. And I think for me, shortly after arriving in Bozeman, my husband and I parted ways as a result of domestic violence. So my daughter and I are survivors and getting back on our feet. And just, you know, this conversation is really about our experience, mine as an immigrant woman who comes from sort of a well-educated middle-class home, and how this experience of domestic violence as it relates to my life here in the U.S. and the pandemic, bringing those two things together, the experience that I've had in the United States and with these sometimes what I would consider interesting policies and laws, and how we've experienced those and how they've affected our day-to-day lives as we pull ourselves out of a very difficult situation. I think similarly to many American citizen women and men who are survivors also of domestic violence, and how the pandemic has affected us. So thank you for having us, having me, having Lori. And I encourage everyone to come into this with an open mind and be aware of some potentially preconceived notions that I think in some ways we all carry, but that, you know, walk alongside us with our experience and engage with us in the conversation in that way. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Rima. Tara Jensen, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your work?
Hi, everyone. My name is Tara Jensen. I am the co-director of the Montana Budget and Policy Center. We are a nonprofit organization, and we focus on research and analysis of public policies that most impact Montanans living on low and moderate incomes. We believe that a thoughtful and robust state budget is how we best invest in our communities and our families to give us the best possible state for everyone. And I'm really happy to be here, and I'm happy to listen alongside of you two wonderful women.
Thank you so much. Lori, let's start with you, and then let's go to Rima. Lori, how has COVID-19 impacted you and your family?
In a lot of ways. Many of my family members' employment has been affected. My daughter was furloughed and is getting unemployment, but depending on what Congress decides, it could run out this week, and she's not been able to secure employment yet. With so many other people having their unemployment benefits ending, the jobs that are available are poverty-level wage jobs. Displaced workers made more money on unemployment. Other family members are essential workers, but they had their hours cut due to the pandemic. One of my sons was working as a laborer for a construction company, but lost out on 2 weeks of pay when I became sick and they tested me for COVID. Thankfully, it was negative, but his employer told him he had to self-quarantine for 14 days and he was not paid for that time. He was working up in Big Sky. Crews would meet at their office in Four Corners and drive up together in a work vehicle. And you can't exactly socially distance in a work vehicle. So my son was leery of staying with that company. Before the pandemic, my children did not have guaranteed work hours week to week, and now it's even more in flux. The pandemic has really exacerbated the holes that already exist in our system. People are paying much higher than they can afford for health care. People are working jobs that don't pay enough for them to survive. And lack of paid sick leave for low-wage jobs has impacted everyone. Those that need to take time off of work to quarantine may have had the ability to go back to work, but they didn't get paid during those 2 weeks. All of these issues need to be addressed if we're going to recover from this crisis.
Thank you. Rima, how has COVID-19 affected you and your family?
Thank you. Lori, I absolutely echo so much of what you said. I think primarily for me, what comes to mind is certainly my work hours have been affected. I've worked as a consultant for a good period since I arrived. I work in health and human services and have a doctorate in transformative psychology. So I've worked for myself in various capacities for a long time. And so that has obviously been affected because people aren't necessarily wanting the same kinds of services. And fortunately, I come from a very entrepreneurial home and so have been able to pull pieces together. And that's been difficult because I had a 2.5-year-old at home. Her daycare, her school was closed March 16th and did not reopen till June. And so while trying to work in that period, I think the other big thing for me, I unexpectedly became caretaker of both my parents who are close to their 80s. And this is an emotional piece for me. It, you know, I thought, oh my gosh, being a single mom was so hard. And this isn't meant in any way to dishonor the experience of another single mom or parent. But I'll tell you, it's for those of you who have parents who are seniors, it is something I could never have expected. And so having my work hours adjusted, just as I was starting to get back on my feet, as I said, I am a survivor of domestic violence and still have some physical injuries, and navigating the trauma that is associated to that, and then a very messy divorce and the legal system and all of those pieces. But then trying to be a mom, a healthy, good mom, as I rebuild both my financial circumstances and my emotional health and support this child and healthy development for her and navigating the trauma that she's experienced as a result, but also now navigating two seniors. And my dad certainly has much more need than my mom, and that was unexpected. And so navigating all of those pieces together, and while I just started to in March get some pieces pieces in place with the senior center and some care that comes into our home and that kind of stuff. Obviously, with the pandemic, that all went away, and the additional supports that I had for my daughter Valentina, like babysitters and that kind of stuff, you know, all of those things went away. So trying to juggle the financial side of, oh my God, how am I going to pay rent? And how am I going to make ends meet? And in the midst of that, you know, dealing with an ICE hearing because my husband called immigration on me. And so all of these pieces kind of coming together without a whole lot of supports and networks. As I said, I'm from Canada and I've lived in the UK and all over the world. And so coming to learn the system in the US and certainly in Montana, which is very different than New York, understanding what pieces we have in place to support those in need. And I can certainly say that age 39 is a really late start to learn to ask for help. And so I've never needed help really, like significant help where I'd need to go to the government or use some of the state services was really difficult for me. I also was raised in an immigrant home where it was pick yourself up, brush yourself off and get going. That piece of it alongside being raised in Canada most of my life in the UK, that there are typically supports that support people through this. And so adjusting to, oh my gosh, I'm now caring for two 80-year-olds and a 2.5-year-old, navigating the legal system, the ICE hearing and all of these things in the middle of a pandemic and all the fear that comes with that, with all the people around me, was emotionally draining. And certainly there were very little supports in place. And then the financial piece is just as Lori described, how am I going to make this work? And because of my green card status, which I am a legal green card holder, a conditional holder, which I'll get into in a few minutes, it prevented me from accessing most social services. And so for those of you who don't know, and I'll go into this more in just a moment, as a conditional green card holder, I was married to my husband less than 2 years. So in the US, 1 in 3 are considered fraudulent marriages. So they require people like me to be on a conditional green card so that after 2 years, they can re-interview us and make sure that it was a legitimate marriage. A green card holder who's been here for under 5 years can't access social services, any of them. And so with the newest laws being brought in, I've recently gotten my permanent status, but I can, as I apply for my US citizenship, I can't even access social services for myself, I also can't access additional supports that I'm going to have to share when I do apply for my status for my citizenship, because I can't be seen as a public charge. And so it creates a lot of scenarios for me as an immigrant. I can't access the same kinds of services that potentially an American citizen could, despite the fact that my daughter is an American citizen and despite the fact that I am a survivor of domestic violence at the hands of an American citizen. So that's been my experience thus far.
Thank you. We have an attendee that says WIC can be used if you're not a permanent citizen. You might look into that, but we hear your story. Tara, from Montana Budget and Policy Center's perspective, what's the financial toll we can expect to see on children and families in Montana?
Well, Montana, like the rest of the country, is in a rough spot. Our child care capacity in the state was reduced by over 10,000 slots. That's slowly coming back, but Montana was not in a position pre-pandemic to fill the need in our state. 29,000 renters are behind on rent. There are 71,000 adults and 32,000 kids who report not having enough to eat because they can't afford it. At our unemployment peak was as high as 11.9% in April. It has gone down a little bit, but it is still clearly too high. Medicaid expansion enrollment is going up as people are losing job attached healthcare, and also as hours are being cut and incomes are going down. You know, and even some of the services that and support that the federal government put in place, like the economic impact payments, aren't going to as many people as they could. There's 25,000 Montanans who, because of low incomes or other reasons, don't file taxes every year. They didn't automatically receive their payment. And so connecting with them for a family of four, that could be as much as $3,400, which is significant, especially in a time like now. You know, revenues, their predictions are starting to come in that Montana will experience a loss of $67 million in FY20 and as much as or around $213 million in FY21, which is significant. Montana is seeing a little different impact because we don't have a sales tax. So our big revenue impacts will be felt next year as individual income tax rules come in and corporate income tax, and then the reduced oil and gas production taxes. That's going to have some dramatic impacts on our state. And it comes on top of cuts from 2017, where we saw a reduction in state revenue and state general fund cuts comboed with the loss of matching federal funds. We lost about $200 million in funded services through DPHHS. And even though some of that funding was replenished, much damage was done. If you'll remember, there were significant cuts to targeted case management. The state closed 19 offices of public assistance. I mean, the list goes on. And families are still feeling those cuts. You know, there's also a lot of talk about comparison to the Great Recession. And I could go on and on about the Great Recession, but just quickly, you know, Montana did fare a little bit better than some of the other states. We didn't have the same level of obvious budget cuts that other places felt. Ours were felt a little bit more subtly. Harm done was through budget strategies, through things like vacancy savings and lowering present law adjustments and other kind of budget techniques that don't always look or are reported as budget cuts, but certainly feel like budget cuts and are felt deeply to families and communities. And it's these types of cuts that, well, really all cuts take years or even decades or generations to build back. And that's kind of where we're at in Montana right now. So I can talk a lot more later about kind of some of how we think we can move things forward, but that's kind of the state of affairs in Montana right now.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for that. Rima, what has your experience been like trying to access public programs generally or other relief money that's being offered in the time of the pandemic?
That's a really great question. So as I just mentioned, because of my green card status, I actually can't access any social services whatsoever for the first 5 years of my life here. And so my daughter is an American citizen and can have things like Medicaid and also SNAP. But the interesting thing is that it took me a really long time to get for her because I'm not eligible. I'm not allowed to apply for those things. They have to go through the American citizen person or my sponsor. So I can't, it took me like using the senator's office to help me get access to those supports because I'm technically not allowed to apply for her. So in addition to the fact that I can't have any social services or supports because of my green card status, Valentina's access to those things came with literally hundreds of hours of phone calls and application of the process and the submissions and the court documents, all of those things. The stimulus that we were all supposed to get, the IRS gave that to my husband, and there's been no access to that money for me, despite him admitting in court that he has taken it, with the belief that the government felt that he, as head of household, literally that was the term, should be able to spend that money as he saw fit. So I've had none of those supports. I've been able to adjust my tax documentation, which I couldn't have access to as a conditional green card holder, just to be clear, which didn't allow me to return to Canada because I couldn't reestablish my own residency without my taxes. I've done my taxes through the IRS now, but that's a backlog, as many of you know. So I didn't have access and don't have access to that money. The process, it appears to me, and this is from my experience of living abroad here, is just, it's a bit of a convoluted process. I think that legislators and people in those policy making decisions, like the ability to make those decisions, I think truly do have the intention of supporting people and doing right for citizens. I wonder though, if they were to go through the process and see what's actually involved in these applications and things, whether they might take a different approach. I suspect they would, because it is not, you know, I come from a culture where these services are intended to support families through difficult times, whether that's short or maybe sometimes long-term, but to help them get back on their feet and to empower families, and in my case, women, to get back on their feet after difficult circumstances. But these processes don't do that. And I wonder if those people who are listening that are in those kinds of roles, whether you could go back and look at the actual process that you require people to follow, and if you could streamline that. Because had I been able to access some of these things a lot faster, I likely would have been at work a lot faster, which is really good for everyone, because the only way the state generates money is through taxes. And so I want to be working and I want to be contributing in those ways. And I just need a little bit of help in the current circumstance. And so certainly I couldn't access those things. And then to be able to access somebody to ask the questions to was very difficult. I know that was circumstance for many people in terms of unemployment and that kind of stuff. You know, the responses just weren't there. And I know that those systems are overwhelmed, and there's got to be a much more effective and efficient way to navigate these things. And I've seen them used in other countries. So I know that I think the U.S. is one of the wisest, most wealthy countries in the world. There's no reason that we shouldn't be able to streamline some of these processes. In addition, I think the stigma that's associated in this country with accessing help as though it's a bad thing and there is a judgment is really, really a heavy burden for people to carry. Mm-hmm. Look, I've never been in this circumstance. I'm well-educated. I come from a People always say to me, well, it's not usually people like you, or it's, I'm surprised, like, this isn't the story that I hear from women like you, or, you know, as though domestic violence and financial difficulties and poverty don't happen to people like me, but they do. And it's, I heard someone say, it's like the flip of a coin. He emptied bank accounts, spent money on credit cards and the debt that was in, it's all in my name. And then all of a sudden there is a circumstance where I've got all these bills and a very difficult financial legal circumstance that puts me in a really bad situation where I might need some help from maybe the state. There isn't that. And then asking for help is a really difficult thing, especially here when it seems that the culture looks down upon people who may need help, where there is a judgment around domestic violence, around being poor, around needing some support for a short period of time. In addition to that, my last point would be that I can't even risk getting public help because it will affect my citizenship status. And the judge at my ICE hearing asked me, well, why don't you just go back to Canada? Yeah, I'd go back to Canada in a minute with my child. And so this whole thing was about separating me from my American citizen daughter. And so I can't do anything that would ever impact or even remotely possibly impact being viewed as a public charge in the eyes of the government that would separate me from my daughter. And so all of those pieces together, I know that's a lot in 3 or 4 minutes to say, but that's my life at the moment. And those are some of the things that I think Americans and those of you who are listening that have access to some of the decision-making and writing policies need to understand and know how the actual implementation of some of these things actually works in the real world.
Thank you. That's a lot. Lori, what is your experience and that of your family accessing public programs or other relief measures during the pandemic?
I echo a lot of what Rima had said about the stigma, because there's an unfortunate stigma associated with public assistance programs. And contrary to public opinion, most individuals are not looking for a handout. Most individuals are not trying to avoid working a job. Speaking from my own experience, I'm a student at the university, and I'm only allowed to work 20 hours a week for the university. With classes on top of work and homework and being a single mom, working more than 20 hours a week really is taxing and stretches me beyond my capacity. I was trying to be proactive with the pandemic and my daughter being furloughed, and I thought, well, maybe now I can qualify for SNAP because I was deemed ineligible before. So I got on the site and I spent 3.5 hours on the state website trying to apply for SNAP, but the site kept crashing and causing me to have to log back in, but it didn't save any of my information. It was a frustrating process. The application is very long and tedious, and some of the questions are a little confusing as to what they're asking. I know in Montana, you can apply for Medicaid and SNAP using a single application, but I wonder if the application could be further streamlined and the online application made a bit more user-friendly. I think that many times when people are designing policies and programs, they aren't actually collaborating with the people that receive those services. They're only collaborating with each other. At the time that I was applying, we were at the beginning of the pandemic. I know that there were already staffing shortages in the Office of Public Assistance after the 2017 legislative session with the budget cuts and with increased people applying for SNAP benefits due to the pandemic. It didn't make the shortages within the Office of Public Assistance any easier. At the time that I applied, callbacks were more than a week out for your phone interview. When I got my call, I was at work and I missed the call. And so I had to go back in and go back into the queue and start all over again. This makes it very difficult for people to access program and services. It would be very beneficial if applicants could schedule somehow online when they're submitting their application for their callback interview. If I didn't know any better, I would think that the application process is designed to deter people from applying. It almost feels like it's a gauntlet of sorts, and that only the strong and the persistent are going to get through it and be rewarded with benefits. That's my perception. And it seems that the common perception is that it's easy to apply and qualify for these services, when in reality, it's not. It is not easy, and it is a full-time job to even get to the point of receiving services. Evidently, I wasn't one of the lucky ones. I rarely have enough income to pay my basic bills each month, let alone feed a family of four. I often end up having to choose between which bills to pay in any given month. Based on how they calculate eligibility, I don't qualify for SNAP. For example, if I was able to get $200, just $200 a month in SNAP benefits, that would free up $200 to go towards rent, utilities, or some other pressing expense. Thankfully, in the Gallatin Valley, we have a fantastic food bank. The staff and the volunteers did a phenomenal job adjusting to the new safety guidelines and creating a drive-up, no-contact pickup for food boxes during the whole stay-at-home order. That being said, the food bank is designed for emergency food, approximately 5 days worth. It's not intended to be a family's only source of food for the month. SNAP, on the other hand, is meant to support a family throughout the month. People retain their dignity, feel empowered, and still feel normal by being able to shop for their own food at the grocery store. Also, SNAP recipients are spending their food dollars locally, which has a cascading effect on the economy, providing income to producers and distributors of food. SNAP is an essential program that needs more funding. It needs broader funding, not less. If more families qualified for SNAP, it would benefit all Montanans.
So there is information that was shared with me prior to this, that for every dollar spent on SNAP, there's $1.54 return on investment. Mm-hmm. And so that's money spent on Main Street that recirculates through the economy, because this money can't be saved. Mm-hmm. It's needed by its recipients, and it's an essential investment in our communities. Lori, as a follow-up to what we've heard from you, in what ways do you believe the pandemic connects to the larger issue of poverty?
I've lived all over the United States. My ex-husband was military, and I've lived all over. The culture in Montana is a bit different than other states I've lived in. In Montana, there's a strong belief that if you work hard and pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you're going to succeed. That has not been my experience, because no matter how hard I work, how hard I try, how hard I push, my family and I still struggle. This pandemic really shows how anything can happen to anyone at any time, and we're all vulnerable. People can work their whole lives and have their entire savings wiped away by being out of work for 2 months or less, in my case. Basic needs like healthcare, food, housing, childcare, so people can get back to work, as well as mental health services, should be guaranteed. No question. We should not be talking about cutting funding for programs that help Montanans to function, especially in a pandemic. It is the state and country's responsibility to provide these, because how can we possibly rebuild our society or function as a society when people are struggling to provide basic needs? Also, this pandemic is impacting people in poverty much more than the middle and upper classes. And it will take us much longer to recover from this. Being in poverty is like trying to chase a runaway train that I'm never going to catch. Even before this, when you're poor, you're always behind and you're trying to catch up. Catching up from this will be nearly impossible for some people, because those in poverty do not have expendable surplus income. People are falling further and further and further behind on their bills. But when they finally start working again, they're not going to be making enough to pay their bills in that present moment. let alone catch up on the bills they're behind on. Many wealthier people banked the stimulus check. Believe me, I heard a lot of people say that they bought flat screen TVs or put away for our vacation. I paid some back rent and bought some groceries for my family. There is no extra. And that makes me pose a question myself. How can our response to this be equitable so that those on the bottom even have a chance of getting back on their feet?
Thank you. It's my experience that poverty and food insecurity are hidden right in front of us. And knowing Lori, if you saw her walking down the street, you would never guess that she was living in poverty, challenged. She's impeccable. She's put together. Her clothes aren't fancy or expensive, but she cares and she shows it. She presents professionally. People with lesser means are some of the most creative people I know. They're problem solvers, troubleshooters. They don't have a lot to work with, but they patch it together. And that's why public support and programs like SNAP are vital. Rima, what do you believe Montanans need in order to get back on their feet as we recover from the crisis that is the pandemic?
Thank you. I echo a lot of what Lori's just shared in my thoughts to this question. I think we all go through needing help in some capacity at some point in our lives. It's just a part of being human. And I come from a culture where Americans always laugh when I say this. I love paying taxes. I come from a culture where it is such a privilege to be working and to be contributing back to the community. It says that I have a job. It says that I'm contributing in some way, and that the money that the government takes in terms of my taxes goes back into society to support something. For us in Canada, it's always roads and education and healthcare. So I love paying taxes. Lori touched on SNAP and some of these other sort of programs that are looking at being cut. And I hear these stories about people just making just a little more and then they are removed from SNAP. I think that what Montana needs to look at is not the 4-year, 2, 4, or 8-year cycle that politicians have to look at. I think the stats and the data are out there. And I could spend all day talking about that stuff. If we help people to build up, we bolster people with the foundational, the basic human needs, transportation, mental health, food, rent, those things. And if we can support people through those things and not just cut them off immediately, give them 6 months, give them a year to get back on their feet, to start saving money, to get comfortable in their work, to get the mental health supports. Because I think for me, the foundation of everything is a healthy mind. And so when we're mentally stable and well, however you want to describe that, that all other things are possible. When people aren't stressing and worried about or dealing with the trauma of some life circumstance or stressing about not having enough food for their kids, that's insane to me today in the US in 2020. If we can support people to have those basic human needs and then bolster families, help them with education, skills, the ability to get back on their feet and back into the workforce and faster, not only does that support women, families, children in need, it supports society as a whole. Because when I'm working, when you're working, when we're all working, we're paying taxes. And that's how the state makes its money in order to support the citizens of its state and the country. And so for me, it is, let's support people. Let's help them get back on their feet. Let's support them for a period of time so that they can remain on their feet. Again, those are the stats and the data. When we support them for a period of time, it helps them to build a cushion and a solid foundation and then pull them off and fill those gaps with other community supports to keep them up long-term. And other countries have those experiences and the data that we can look at. Why not do that here? I think Montana can absolutely be a leader in that way. And I think streamlining the process to access some of these things will be the other key to this. So people know that they've got access to the basics and that they have the process that they can follow that's understandable and people they can talk to help get those things in place. I think that really supports the immediate need for people to feel safe and secure. And that's what this is really about. And then they can free up that sort of space in their minds and in their lives to get themselves back to work or in a place where they're contributing to an employer or their businesses or whatever their means of income is.
Yeah, thanks. Lori, what about you? What do you think Montanans need in order to get back to recover from the pandemic?
Social safety net programs do not create an adequate cushion or transition. They make it harder for people to grow their income and lift out of poverty because most of the time, for low-income people, the raises they get are small, enough to kick them off of benefits, but not enough to get by. People in poverty aren't usually making jumps of $12 an hour to $18 an hour. This creates a cycle that those in poverty cannot break out of. The current system is set up to punish those that are trying to improve their status in life. There's no in-between for those that need healthcare but can't afford employer-provided insurance coverage. Healthcare is a basic human right. It's not a luxury. I, like so many others living in poverty, depend on the earned income tax credit. The earned income tax credit is a tax credit for low to moderate income working people and is the largest anti-poverty program we have in the United States. I realize that it is mostly federal money and a little state money. With that being said, Montana's EITC is only 3% of the federal, making it the smallest of any state EITC in the country. The EITC is the largest safety net those living in poverty have. If I didn't have the EITC, I would not be able to get caught up on medical bills, pay for car repairs, and stock up on groceries. When you're making poverty level wages, there is no extra cushion. The EITC is our cushion. We should be strengthening and increasing funding for these programs that help people to survive. Cuts to these programs have a direct impact on people's ability to make ends meet. We can strengthen Montana's EITC and support families.
Thank you. Tara, from the Montana Budget and Policy Center's perspective, what recommendations for how communities and the state as a whole can take action to protect Montanans and ensure that we are fully able to recover from the pandemic?
Yeah, thanks for that. Lori, you took some of my EITC talking points. Nicely done. Love the EITC. So I want to talk a little bit kind of about Montana Budget and Policy Center's latest project called Big Sky, Brighter Future. I want to acknowledge that, of course, there have been some federal aid packages. There's another being negotiated. And those are tending to focus on how to kind of survive this pandemic. And our Big Sky, Brighter Future plan is more than that. It's a vision about how to rebuild. How can we rebuild to something better, something that doesn't leave people behind? We need policies in Montana that help communities and families be more resilient so mm-hmm. we can weather storms that are to come, because there will be more. We need concrete policy plans that create a better future so we all have what we need, not just in times of crisis like right now, but every day. And so for months, MBPC met with community partners and direct service providers, experts, policymakers, advocates, and asked them what forward-thinking policy should Montana be considering to make real progress to improve the health of communities and families and kids. We collected dozens of ideas, and then we really did our due diligence, researching them, refining them, and then checking back with people to see if we're on the right path. In the end, we ended up with 35 policies that can help us build a brighter future. We broke the policies into a few buckets, so families, education, workers, and communities. I'm only going to go through a couple of them because 35 would take up a long time, but I do encourage everyone to go to bigskybrighterfuture.org, and we have everything laid out there. We have fact sheets so you can tell about how we got here, how these policies will build a more equitable future, and how we envision it being implemented. A couple of the many are, you know, really investing in affordable utilities to reduce the backlog of low-income weatherization needs. We need to pass a paid family medical leave program in Montana so everyone has access. And MBPC's done some research around a robust policy that you can definitely check out as well. We need to be investing in affordable housing in many ways, but also specifically for youth aging out of foster care. We can use Medicaid to cover supportive housing services for patients experiencing homelessness and high healthcare costs. We need to raise the minimum wage. We need to protect workers through fair scheduling laws. We need to guarantee workers can earn 5 paid sick days per year. We want to expand the EITC to 20% of the federal and expand it so that even people who don't have children can receive it. And for those who are older than 65 or starting out in their careers between 18 and 24. Montana needs to be investing in pre-K and childcare. We need to invest more in higher ed for need-based aid in our tribal colleges. We need to expand SNAP and TANF assistance for people attending post-secondary for kids in school. A couple others are investing in public school infrastructure and technology. I think it's become very clear that we need to do more in technology if we're going to weather future storms. In the terms of justice reform, we can invest in mental health and addiction services. We can establish tribal reentry programs and holistic defense systems for American Indians on probation and parole. We can enact laws to end cash bail and limit the use of bail so we can start to crack down on kind of that perpetual cycle. Those are just a couple. There are many more, and definitely in our effect sheets, you should all look through and we can you can dig into more. But I know that the question always is how do we pay for that? And I'm glad that taxes were brought up because MBPC, as part of this plan, has 10 proposals for raising revenue that policymakers should seriously consider. They're not only important to bring in new revenue to help our state and communities, but they're also important tax fairness measures. And in all, they bring in $241 million a year. That's real money in Montana. And these are policies that would not impact most Montanans. I can dig in more and more. I mean, we love to talk about taxes at MBPC, but I encourage everybody to go and check them out. And this is definitely one way we can build a better tomorrow for our whole state.
Thank you. Thank you. So we're almost getting to our time and we do have some questions and answers. But for Lori and Rima, what is the one thing you'd like listeners to take away from the panel today? Lori, you go first and then we'll follow up with Rima.
I guess first that those in attendance would realize that when things go back to normal, whatever normal is going to look like, things will still not be normal for many people who are already vulnerable. They will continue to be vulnerable. It could be a year or more before people who are earning poverty level wages will be financially caught up again, if they ever do catch up. And second, that these conversations would continue beyond this panel. We can no longer say that we need to do something and then nothing ever changes. Action needs to be taken that will have long lasting benefits for people living in poverty.
What about you, Rima?
Thank you. I think I would ask the panelists to take the time after this conversation to really put yourself in the situation that Lori and I have described. Certainly for me as a single parent with the background that I've had, that many of you are probably married or in long-term committed relationships. Many of you are probably parents. So really take the time to put yourself in my shoes and imagine what it would be like. And for those of you who are policy and decision makers, before you start down that path to changing policy or adjusting policy or writing new policy, really think about the people who are affected by what you're implementing or the policy that you're writing so that you can truly understand, because I do believe that you're doing it to help people and to help society, to help our community, but really put yourself in the shoes of the individual that you're intending to help and think about, truly think about whether it is going to help them and whether it is what you would want if you were in this situation. Because God knows I never thought I'd be in the situation that I am, and I am, and it can happen to anybody with any kind of background. So I really encourage you to think about that. And for those of you who are in areas of family law, to continue to advocate for those laws. And that's the work I'm doing outside of here, that those family laws, that it's over 70% of women who come out of divorces fall to or below the poverty line for at least a decade. So thinking about how our laws, not only sort of the policies that are put in place in some other areas around SNAP and Medicaid, but the laws that are around families and children and women and domestic violence, and how those things contribute to some of the conversation that we're having today.
Thank you. Tara, is there evidence that budget cuts to social services provide a more equitable society?
There's lots of evidence out there that it's investment in communities that make a more equitable society, having thoughtful, adequate revenue into a state that comes from equitable sources and is invested in our communities. That's what creates a more equitable society.
Thanks. What is the private sector's ability to respond to the increased demand for services during the pandemic and the public services are cut? Does the private sector have the ability to fill in some of the gaps?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's kind of this ongoing question anytime budget cuts roll around. And I just think that it's pretty clear that I come from the nonprofit sector. I have worked in it for a long time. I have a tremendous amount of respect for the organizations, but the nonprofit sector can't make up for a well-functioning government, for a government who's thoughtfully providing services that take care of citizens. I think some people think of nonprofit and private sectors being different, but they're in the same realm, a little different. Private donations going into nonprofits, I think, serve an important role, and it's part of how services are rendered, and they can be good partners to government, but they cannot take the place of a well-functioning government.
Thank you. I think that we look to churches for that too. Churches and nonprofits can only do so much, but thank you. There is another question here. What is the latest update on state and federal moratorium on rent and mortgage evictions? That might be something that's in these bills that I'm not fully aware of right now. Anyone?
I don't think I have the latest update on, I have not read the latest package, but I can definitely, if somebody wants to reach out to me, I can definitely do some research.
That's a pretty tough one. There's a lot of appreciation for you sharing your stories, Lori and Rima. We learn from that. Lori and Rima, any specific recommendations on how to make some of the SNAP application less tedious and more streamlined? Because I heard a lot about streamlining today. And honestly, that's one of the lessons and takeaways from the pandemic is like, we're learning how to create an online environment. And so some of these tools are quite old, but they can be improved.
The application itself, it's great that it's available online, but it's very overwhelming when you sit down to start filling it out. And I've filled it out. I used to be on SNAP and then all of a sudden I don't qualify anymore, which is kind of confusing to me. But and some of the regulations, as far as if you have people living in your household, they're your children, but they're 22 years old or under, you still have to count their income, even if as a parent, I am requiring them to buy their own food and be self-sufficient. I still have to count their income. And that's the other issue with the LEAP application for energy assistance. I have to count anyone 18 and over in my household, so I never qualify for it. So I don't know. I am not a software designer, so I can't give any kind of advice in that arena about how to streamline it, but it is very frustrating. And in some of my research when I was reading, there are more simplified applications, from my understanding, for elderly to apply for SNAP. And I just wonder if they can simplify it for people 65 and older, why can't they simplify it just across the board?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think looking at the actual questions themselves, I don't have them in front of me, but I'd be more than happy to sit with the person that asked that. Look, I don't think we need to recreate the wheel. Other states are doing really phenomenal jobs at streamlining a lot of these processes and bringing the Department of Health and Human Services together, like all of these different pieces that one can apply for. When I applied for Valentina, I couldn't do Medicaid and SNAP together for whatever reason. And aside from that, I love that it's online, but they forced me to go in because I guess of my circumstance that I couldn't provide a lot of the documentation, but there must be a better way to do that because other states are doing that. So certainly the questions themselves, but also creating another way. I can't be the only legal immigrant that is trying to fill these things out for their child. 43% of immigrant women like me marrying American citizen men have had domestic violence situations. So there must be some process that a person like me can follow for the sake of my child to make it a lot more realistic and literally like 100 hours trying to figure this out. And then I had to get the state senator's office involved until it got up. And that's unnecessary. That is completely unnecessary. The place for me to be able to tell the story so that someone can read it instead of going back and forth several times is just unnecessary. Create the opportunity for me to tell the story, whether that's online or submit one time, confirm the court documents, in a very streamlined, that can't be that difficult to get it certified. So some of those processes, just there are extra steps that just don't need to be there.
Thanks for that. And thank you for being here today with us. In parting, we didn't invite the pandemic to hit us at this time. And we will have to be vigilant in allowing our country and our state to recover from its effects. This means our continued support of programs like SNAP and other programs that offer help to those in need. It's up to us individually and as a community to do things like increasing the federal poverty line, which was outdated and reflects the economic reality of 1964, not 2002 now, where the cost of housing, childcare, gas, cars, insurance, and healthcare are far higher. SNAP benefits for individuals and families are tied to the federal poverty level. And it's simply not an accurate depiction or representation of poverty. Mm-hmm. So let's share these conversations with friends. Keep this in the top of your mind and act on these when the opportunity arises. And again, thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you, panelists, for your wonderful work, all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have just heard a virtual panel discussion titled Poverty and the Pandemic, Exploring the Impacts of the COVID-19 Pandemic on Our Community. It was a collaboration of Montana No Kid Hungry and HRDC District 9 in Bozeman. The discussion was facilitated by Elizabeth Marum of TRIO Student Support Services at Montana State University. The three panelists were Amplify Montana members Rima Zabian and Lori Lundgren, and Tara Jensen, co-director of the Montana Budget and Policy Center. More information can be found at bigskybrighterfuture.org. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production produced by Joy LaClaire in Bozeman, Montana, for broadcast and archiving on listener-supported Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman. Thanks to Stephen Durbin and Rochelle Sartori for production assistance. You can support KGVM by going to kgvm.org and click on the support button at the top of the page. We do thank you for listening and supporting KGVM.